the chemical body landscape, which was basically a literate defined body, and then the TV body and the chip body, all floating in among each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the Android meme.
The Android meme is all of it together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you generally are active when you're on your chip body. You're looking, going, two-way interaction, call it. But TV mm-hmm. has always been a passive. Even though your eyeball is very active, but for most people, you sit back and receive what's broadcast at you. You take a break from the proactive chip body experience.
Mm-hmm.
And you veg out, you know, with the TV body. So another thing about the eye broadcasting, what was it? So in the literate phase, religious experience was God shone his light on me. Variations of that. And God looked upon you, that you passively receiving the, you know, the transcendence, the bliss or whatever of God looking at you. And then tribal people, they broadcast, so they made reality. So their God was a participatory thing where they helped make the rain or whatever participatory stuff, you know, Aboriginal peoples did. They knew that they were half the story in making the universe.
Right, that is what the Aborigines do. They go to the dream time and they manifest. That's what they do in the dream time. They're fourth dimensional. They are completely telepathic. And they know, and they create reality in the dream time.
Right, so that's a program. They program their environment. The literate person is a consumer of the environment, passively accepts what's given
to them. Mm-hmm.
So isn't that useful ideas to swallow up a lot of confusing particulars?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why? Of course, you want to be the programmer of your environment.
Yeah. Well, they did it with their chemical body, but we now do it with huge mediascapes. We're all McLuhan programming the global theater, but it's a tiny global theater now, individually.
Mm-hmm.
So what he used to say in the 60s that the modern person would watch a little TV, then listen to a little radio, then go read a newspaper or then get in his car, go around to individual media. But we do that cycle with our thumb. We go to a newspaper page or a TV or a movie, or we can have a fast video that makes it like we're driving a car. So all of that is that McLuhan wanted to manage on a big level. So the average experience was in the 60s was to have this separate, different media experiences. But that was individual sort of consumption of them. What about programming the whole society of all these different media? That's what he proposed. And then it all shrunk down that you program your situation. And today, other than knowing that the chip body give you this ability, you're not affected by media anymore. McLuhan's terms don't apply today. You are programming your environment. You're talking back to it, and you can't even define what the environment is. You don't know where you are when you're on the global membrane, the internet. You're wherever other people are that are either got surveillance on you or they're interacting with you or watching you. When I walk to the beach, a lot of time I walk by people who are holding up their cell phone and showing the sunset or something and talking to somebody who's there on the screen talking back at them. So they're in Canada and Hawaii at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because someone in let's say someone's broadcasting, they're talking to someone in Japan, someone in that Japanese household is watching, like I am, the person talking from Hawaii. I'm watching the person from Japan. And the person in Japan is looking at the woman on the beach in Maui. So they're in two places at the same time. Your physical body can't do that.
And where are we right now, Bob? Where
right. I'm, you know, your relatives would be in the background listening. So I'm there in their space and they're in my space if they were there consciously. And then this show is tapped, so all the intelligence agencies are listening, and we're there, and they're here.
And they're the only ones listening, the intelligence agency.
That's right. They are the most regular attenders of the shows. They probably have great inventories that make Akito's inventory very puny looking, probably.
They're the only ones paying attention. Bob.
What'd you say?
We'll allow Bill Binney in. He's fine.
Yeah, Since Bill can participate. yeah. Bill Binney, BB. He's a 22 guy.
BB, we'll bring him in. Bill, you're welcome, buddy. Come and listen to the greatest voice in the world.
Yeah, the greatest pattern recognizer. Your NSA digital program is puny compared to what we do here.
Absolutely.
We stop wars all the time.
Yeah, and start them.
Yep. Sometimes we got to start them. The balanced situation here. We don't take sides. We just want to diminish the stress.
And if you're on the drops, your rate of survival is high. If you're not, well, sorry for you, buddy.
Yeah, Bill, you can come in for a couple of shows without the drops, but after that, you better take the drops.
You better start taking
the show.
You got 18 months.
Yeah. 18 months.
And don't analyze a thing, Bill. Don't analyze a thing.
It's more like 5 days, Bill, so you better really chug down that bottle. It's the 23rd of September is around the corner.
FedEx it. Call Ginny, FedEx the bottle to yourself.
FedEx immediately,
Overnight delivery.
Okay, so
a rebob.
Right. Okay, so we're looking at part three or page three of this proposal, and it's called consequences. So we heard purpose, then
Where's Roxanne?
Hypothesis. I know she's either sleeping or listening. Are you there, Roxanna?
Roxy.
Hey. Let's see. Did she send an email saying she's not here? Let's see. We're lost. No emails.
Okay, she'll be back.
Right. Okay, so we're at part three. So, under consequences, there are 5 points. Ideas or messages presented in a form which are not in accord with the sense ratio of the culture would be ignored, regardless of the quality of the content or the ideas or messages. Give words and structures will be required to put across motions and content which may be oral or tactile. Each sensory typology introduces its own order, which to an unsuspected degree monitors individual and group thinking. Read that again. Each sensory typology introduces its own order, which to an unsuspected degree monitors individual and group thinking, shapes it.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth point. The TV revolution in the technology of communication has contributed to a concern with dehumanization in industry brought about by automation. The TV revolution in the technology of communication has contributed to a concern with dehumanization in industry brought about by automation. The fifth point, he has a bracket beside it, and he has omit, so he's not sure if he's going to leave this in. The sensory typology of over 100,000 people in our own company, that would be the IBM company, is affected also. The sensory typology of over 100,000 people in our own company is affected also. It follows that the response, attitudes, ideas, in fact, image of IBM to our own employees could be an unknown and shifting quantity at the present time. So it follows that the response, attitudes, ideas, in fact, image of IBM to our own employees could be an unknown and shifting quantity at the present time. So that's that one. Then you go to part four. So, Kirsta, take this to your brother or a relative. Say, I propose this, and read these things to him. What would he say to you? that sounds like Trumpism. That sounds like fascism.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is an article about this press conference by one paper, and they say, writer urges red controls over society. Red, meaning communist. It sounds like communist to these people to mass program collectivity. Literate man doesn't see that kind of mass thing being part of his society, so he thinks it's McLuhan's a communist.
Aye, aye, aye.
Advocates red controls. You know, reds was what the communists were called back then.
Yeah.
The reds. Okay, so we now come to page 4, and it says, so part of this, what I'm reading, was written by Dr. Daniel Capon, a Jungian psychologist and part engineer who was on McLuhan's committee. So he may have written that, because it says here, notes taken from the blackboard after Dr. Capon's report at 96 St. Joseph Street on June 2nd, 1967. So 96 St. Joseph Street was where McLuhan's office was. And so for a while, before 1968 when he got the coach house, his office was the Center for Culture and Technology. And you can see a picture of it. It has a huge office. It has Mark Stewart, secretary, sitting there in 1962, 63, with the kind of glasses women wore at that point, and McLuhan's huge library behind her and all these shelves. So notes taken from the blackboard after Dr. Capon's report at 96 St. Joseph Street on June 2nd, 1967. Present, Harley Parker, Marshall McLuhan, and Max Hillick. Max Hillick was the IBM guy. So there's only four people here. Three guys having a meeting with another guy who made a report for the other three. See, it's this becomes a huge thing. This is, shows you little things cause big changes. This is why we should be proud of the small number of people here.
Hey, nice.
So under point 4, are you still under point 4, or is this a new document?
This is, no, that was 5 points that I read. That was part 3. Now I'm doing part 4.
Okay.
Another image. Another
page.
So the
notes taken is point 3, under point 3.
Under part 4. I've read you 4 pages. Page 1 was purpose. Page 2 was hypotheses. Page 3 was consequences. This has no title, but it's the 4th page.
Okay.
So what it's made up of is the word groups underlined, and then it lists 20 nouns. So under groups, it has toolmaker, manufacturer, 3 is secretary, 4 is wire wrap, 5 is programmers, card machine operators, key punch operators, expediter, unit assembly, number 10, service plan representative, service plan rep, data process, office product sales rep, DP sales rep, stockroom, service product each line, no, service product machine, CE instructor, number 17, indirect inspectors, 18, department manager, 19, OP customs manager, and 20, systems manager. Now, there's a couple of them have asterisks beside them, and it says, note, blue-collar worker. So the toolmaker, the wire wrap, the card machine operators, the unit assembly, and stockroom are blue-collar workers. So he's made a little inventory of different types of functioning chemical bodies. Then there's another column. It says S's. S apostrophe S equals circa 350 plus. And then it says, number one, can one, the word one in quotes, can one predict S-O from 70 plus conscious of sensory usage in job? Don't know what that means. Can one predict? Remember I said last week what S-O stood for? Can't remember. Sensory something? Sensory operation? Can one predict S-O from 70 plus consciousness of sensory usage in job? Point two, does job make a difference to S?
Sensory overload?
No, I don't think it was that. Does job make a difference to S-O? Three, is there an order? So those were questions during the whatever they did to make the report. Then there's another section that says results. One, new prediction worked. Two, training treatment. Three, introduction. Four, means plus order. Five, intersensory correlations. So it's a bit of a inside jargon context. Mm-hmm. Hard to tell what he's telling McLuhan and them. So he's analyzing different environments, workers in different scenes. So that's the sensory, what do I call it? Sensory project, I call it. Four parts. Oh no, here's one. Oh, I did that. Four parts. So anybody have any say?
So that didn't get any legs, that. His idea. Nobody enjoyed that.
Actually, yeah, years later, he said to somebody, I don't know, around 1970, so five or so years later, he said that with their knowledge, Madison Avenue could control the world and you'd have a new mm-hmm. harmony. So advertising is the bloodline of the global theater, or the blood process. He thought if everybody understood that they had no literate values anymore, they didn't have to worry about individual freedom. Why do you bring in individual freedom as an issue about whether you should have an electric system or not?
Mm.
Have light bulbs? Is that infringing on your freedom? So these environments built up around people regardless of what individualist notions they had about their autonomy. So
right, that's true. It does it anyway. So do you want it chaotic or harmonious with consciousness? If you do it consciously, you create harmony. If you do it unconsciously, it's chaotic.
That's right. He said, just as your brain organizes your sensory perceptions, and that's called sensus communis in Latin, I guess. He said, let's implement on a corporate or collective global society level the sensus communis. Let's consciously program all the media, just like our brain programs the senses, and create coherent consciousness and create a complex collectivity.
Right. And that's what you're doing. I mean, you're doing that on a personal level in your ascension process.
Yeah.
Spiritually.
Yeah.
So it's just the leap in the, you know, to do it in a collective way. He's mapped it out in terms of the media, which is pretty genius.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And part of the genius is that he read the Pound, Eliot, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, W.B. Yeats, Wyndham Lewis, James Joyce, what I call the vortices, because they gathered around Wyndham Lewis at a certain point. And he figured out what the larger meaning of their changed, difficult art forms were. And then he figured out that Finnegan's Wake was laying out what we're reading. So that was the, I would say, that people like to say McLuhan predicted the Internet, and they're impressed with that. But I like to say he didn't predict the Internet. He had the genius to see that Finnegan's Wake predicted the Internet. That's something that requires way more smarts to do that, because nobody can read Finnegan's Wake.
And he noticed that it was already happening, that this is what was happening, and suggested that the managers become more involved in
well, comprehensively. So just as all the things that I did led to ION in a nice symmetry in retrospect, McLuhan, what he read, I mean, he read one of his first essays in the early 50s for his collected essays book, he quotes a guy named Lamartine, a French guy in 1830, who declines writing an article for a periodical, a newspaper, because he's more of a poet. And he says, it's not that I have nothing against newspapers. And if you want me to write a book, I'm not even going to do that. He says, the book arrives too late. And then he says, it can't keep up with the newspaper telegraph world, even though this is before the telegraph. And then he says, by the end of the 19th century, the world, he describes this interconnecting, intercommunication among, you know, nations and groups all over the world. You know, what actually happens, what's happening under telegraph conditions, he poetically lays out what's going to happen, and the newspaper will be at the center of it. It's a pretty prophetic statement, but you got to know mm-hmm. about symbolist poets. You have to know about Lamartine. You have to find that quote, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan was lucky in finding, as he said, he doesn't like talking about his sources too much because they're so esoteric.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
But if you're interested, he said, you got to study Joyce and those guys. And so even his new science came from a very unique source that was counterintuitive. Nobody would have figured out what he did or done it that way. Even early media ecologists before him, like Harold Innes, they had no knowledge of the arts, really, like McLuhan did.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have. So McLuhan was the greatest poet of the second half of the 20th century. He was a new kind of poet. He's a poet that influences all kinds of fields of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. He is.
Plus
a poet.
All the other stuff. Yeah, and so it's
that's
a learned
that's
poetry.
Very poetic. Yeah.
Yeah, he actually brought mm-hmm. back the original meaning of poetry, which was basically the science of wisdom, or a kind of wisdom factor that included science knowledge. And he mm-hmm. said included theology. So you can look at Allen Ginsberg, and he's a nice rock and roll poet, spontaneity, a lot of fun. But on the level of poetry being knowledge and new knowledge, McLuhan
mm-hmm.
did it.
Yeah, he did.
And, you know, you read his books, people say, well, is this science? Is this fact? What is it? Well, most people say, well, it's basically poetry. They would see the prose was poetic. Because he would talk in aphorisms and non-factional metaphorical patterns,
mm-hmm.
non-factual.
And all of that you just said, Bob, is Ionic, or to say pre-Ionic.
Yeah, he's a prophet of Ion.
Right, yeah.
So we would go to the next item. Is let's see if nobody's blocked.
But before you do, Bob, Krista said that there was a collective consciousness there, and would there be a collective ascension possible? Would that
well, McLuhan was interpreted in 64 because he was so what appeared to be optimistic about the new electric technology, where everybody else was getting ready for 1984. That they thought he was optimistic, but it was a very complex optimism that included apocalypse, because every new medium would destroy the society. So he knew that was happening. He basically said, I'm providing a vision to help us over the rough waters, just like Alan Cabal said, you know, be a lighthouse. McLuhan was trying to be a lighthouse, mm-hmm. be a guide.
Mm-hmm.
Just intellectually, if you found out that your kid was crazy, because they grew up with TV, this didn't occur to people. They didn't think they thought of themselves as individual billiard balls bouncing off each other. They didn't see the environment was molding them. They didn't even notice that books were no longer as important as television. They still lived in the rearview mirror. They still thought books was the only serious communicating learning medium. TV was just a toy in the living room, you know. They didn't put together what was changing their children.
Mm-hmm.
So just to read about it and get that might relax the mind a bit. Okay, now the mind has a reason why things are odd.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. So the focus was on the books, and meanwhile, sitting lurking in your living room was the TV, which had a way more profound effect on the human psyche than anything else.
Yeah, he used to say the baby would sit in his baby pen, playpen, drinking in Armageddon if the TV was on, you know, at the age of two and three.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
That's
and
deep.
Nobody back then thought about that happening until he pointed it out.
Mm. But that was in the early 60s, though. So, I mean, surely...
Well, the 50s, but he became known 50s. In the 60s.
Yeah. It still had no effect, though. People just continued
right.
to moronically look at the TV and see it
well,
as their entertainment.
Well, that's why he said no philosopher king can control the society. You have to have a collective consensus that, yes, we should turn off TV for 6 months as an environment and assess what it's doing to us. But he knew that one person screaming in the wilderness wasn't going to be listened to.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't enough.
That's
so
right.
So he'd flip it. That's why he'd say, since you people are dumb and not going to notice what's going on, you're living in the past, we're going to have an apocalypse.
Yeah.
Instead of just harnessing and being conscious of,
right.
of what, yeah, and then just bridging yourself into...
Well, people, here's what happened. All the inspired, starting with the human potential movements of the 60s or even the beatniks in the 50s, all these motivational movements came and went because they activated the chemical body and the chemical body's brain and gave them some new ideas, and then they tried awareness techniques in different ways. But nobody knew that was irrelevant. Personal evolution was irrelevant compared to societal evolution. But we would we could consciously control societal evolution. So you go back to 1953, Crick and Watson discover the genetic code, how that programs our bodies, if you believe it. And McLuhan, the same year, began his magazine where he announced all this stuff. And he discovered the macro code, the controlling factor of media effects on societies. A macro code as opposed to a... inner genetic code, you could say a macro outer sociological code.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty a neat
match.
Point.
Yeah, that's like a mirror image.
Yeah, the micro and the macro. They were discovered the same year.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant we could program, just as they're trying to program our genes, now McLuhan, even before doing genes, if regular history is what is a fact, because who knows what's done secretly, but... collectively, we could program our social codes with this knowledge before the genetic code was mastered.
Right. And people have no problem to do genetic tinkering.
Right.
Don't even balk at it.
But a literate society would object to collective tinkering.
Yeah, that just doesn't make any sense that you would have that bias that you could go in and select the sex of your baby or, you know, tinker with anything genetically. It's not a problem at all. It's the same
thing. But collectively deciding you've got to determine the amount of literacy you want to save, how much of a post-literacy you want to create. Nobody, they won't think of, they don't understand that kind of tinkering. They understand genetic tinkering.
And it's the same. It's just, there's no
level. Yeah.
Yeah.
But by extension, Bob, for what you've just said, is the collective then illiterate?
The collective is molded by the media of their time. So people will say, well, Africans have no TV back in the 60s and 70s. Today they say they don't, or they used to say, they don't have cell phones. But what people didn't notice is that the satellite environment went around the whole planet and all previous media, including TV and radio and computers, and it was affecting present industries, macro industries, and previous environments around the world, previous media, and you had to respond to the general response to the satellite theater. So it didn't matter whether you personally had a TV or not. Society was happening on big levels that made you be a a pawn of it or a molecule in it.
Susceptible mm-hmm. to it.
What'd you say?
Susceptible to it on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. So
whether you had the TV or not.
Right. So let's say after World War II, the First World elite knew it was better to decentralize on the land territory level. Territory wasn't that important. Knowledge industries were coming in important. So the Western empires withdrew from colonization. So there was an effect of new media that the Africans didn't even know about. And then all of a sudden they're noticing their white lords are going home. And then the Africans have got to figure out, well, we're in charge here. What do we do? So with all their tribal background, they just have civil war taking over weak industrial leftovers. And then at the same time, they start to get radios and electric media, and they're all hopped up by that. So you're guaranteed chaos in the Third World, which is what happened. You had the civil yeah. wars. And with the CIA run as a literate bureaucracy running around trying to organize some of the content for their purposes, but you have basically huge chaos civil wars in the 60s. In the 70s, into South America is death squads and dictatorships for 20 mm-hmm. years. Sort of like
you don't think of it like that at all, Bob, because you think that there's some other sinister reason
yeah.
for them, you know, creating a civil war. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, these guys are worrying over the fact that they just got a TV. And they're
right.
not realizing the effects of the TV on the chemical body.
Right. Like maybe with one TV in a African village, nobody goes to the well anymore. So there's thousands of years of tradition fucked up right away.
Yeah. Who wants to go to the well when you've got some soapy on? I mean...
yeah, you're watching the soap, not at the well, you're watching at the TV, the soap opera.
Yeah.
Now, there's a book you can get, what a Blow That Phantom Gave Me, where McLuhan's colleague went to Papua New Guinea and introduced media, photographs and books and movies and cameras to the tribal group there that hadn't seen any white men for a long time. And then he documents what happens to him. And in the end, they're all enthusiastic at first, but in the end, they all become drifting guys. Society, the tribe's broken up, and they're in the cities, wandering around trying to find a role in the city or the nearby big town.
Mm.
So these things are startling when you hear them, but they should be part of the public discussion all day long. Those
mm-hmm.
are key issues.
Yeah.
Now, you can say management, they never encourage McLuhan. Management doesn't want the people or some parts of management, whoever are the ones that think that they know something and best that the other people don't know so that you have the elitism of your knowledge and keep your job. It's all economic paranoia. They'll frustrate this whole thing. They'll stop
mm-hmm.
any mention of McLuhan. They'll,
yeah,
they actually try to take tenure. It's just humans, ignorantly interrupting and not understanding what's important, or just taking it too personally. So, again, you aren't going to be an optimist or pessimist when you know this stuff. You're going to be an apocalyptic.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course,
well,
this is all over the news now.
Doesn't end well, Bob.
No, it ends in tears. As I said.
It'll all end in tears.
McLuhan called that Alice in Wonderland tears.
Yeah. Well.
Explain
what
that.
What was the other one? Who's the guys that go to Oz? What's that one called? The Wizard of Oz? Is that what it's called? I forget.
The Wizard
yes.
of Oz. That's what.
The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, does that end in tears? I can't. I don't know if I ever saw it.
No,
everything ends
no,
in
it's
tears,
happy.
Bob. Even Bob
Blacksheep
ends in tears.
What'd you say, Nick?
Even Bob Blacksheep ends in tears. I mean, somebody drops
okay.
the pail and there's crying and there's weeping and wailing. So,
right.
Yeah.
And Jack and Jill ends in tears. They broke their head, didn't they?
They broke their head. Humpty Dumpty fell off the wall.
All tragedies.
Tragedies. <you know. laughs> This is what we're teaching our kids.
We're programmed.
Like, oh, such a lovely little story. Meanwhile, the kid's screaming and worrying. Why are you crying?
Yeah, you just wrecked my childhood. Now I know that it's all going to end up where the king's men and the king's horses can't fix anything, and I'm going to fucking inherit that world. Thanks a lot, Dad.
And yeah, geez, I come up with Bob or Black Sheep, or, you know, little Jack and Jill.
Bob Black Sheep.
Bob Black Sheep.
Bob, B-O-B.
Bob, yeah.
So the McLuhan would be quoting sociologists, anthropologists, you know, obscure poetry, but he always mixed in Humpty Dumpty and Alice in Wonderland. So he'd be reading along some Einstein stuff, and then all of a sudden, well, this shows that Humpty Dumpty was right. You know, he'd bring in the fairy tales. He'd mix it in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of that stuff is in Phineas Wake. Humpty Dumpty, Alice in Wonderland, they're all in there. He was just translating Phineas Wake, or putting the 60 language per page of Phineas Wake, he made it into, reduced it to simple English.
Bob, Finnegan's Wake is very difficult to read. I don't know.
Well, you can't
how you
read
do it,
but... Nick. First of all, you don't try to read it. You learn from McLuhan how to approach it and what it's saying obliquely.
I approach it with care, Bob.
Yes, you
stealthily. I approach it.
You take an aspirin and put a condom on. Do all those things to protect yourself.
Yeah, all those
disease
things.
Virus.
A little black hat when I go surfing.
Yeah,
and, you know,
wear your Eskimo suit. Half the day, then quickly take your clothes and walk. Go run around like a Zulu person with just a cloth on you.
Hair in my hand, Bob. That's what I do. That's the approaching it stealthily.
So what were we doing? We were explaining the media management.
How do you read Finnegan's Wake, Bob, before you got there? How do you read Finnegan's Wake? How do you approach it?
You say, okay, James Joyce, he's a writer, and he wants to be a writer, and he's in Paris in the late, gets here about 1920. He spends the war years in Zurich, you know, hiding out. He's just a liberal pansy coward. He doesn't want to help anybody fight wars. And he, so after the war, he goes to Paris. Okay, so in the 20s, imagine him, he's in his apartment. He's interested in new communications. He was very interested in cinema and had gone to Dublin in 1909 after leaving in 1904 and not going back. He goes back in 1909 and tries to get a bunch of business support to open a movie cinema. So here's a writer and poet, but he knows this new media is interesting and maybe he could get a gig making some money. So he almost opens a cinema in Dublin, but it falls through. So he leaves and has nothing to do with Dublin for decades. But he now is in Paris, so he's got a shortwave radio. So he's going up and he's turning the dial of this monster new invention, and he can hear Dublin, he can hear Switzerland, he can hear Germany, Denmark, he hear all these languages by turning the dial up and down, right? Scanning this probably shortwave. And okay,
not
so
on LSD.
What is this?
It's just normal.
Right. He's just experimenting with the new thing. Or he may not even have one. He visits somebody who does. But as an artist who's concerned about writing and what's the value of writing or what maybe I should get into the newer media, he's going to think about these things. The artist understands sensory effects of media because they have to know that for their own art. They study effects of materials. So he's saying, what's this going to mean for me, the writer? So he puts out Ulysses, which sort of wraps up the whole novelistic enterprise, and then Time magazine, you know, announces in the year 2000 it's the greatest novel of the 20th century. So he's written the greatest novel, even though it's banned for 15 years, you know, 12 years, and all these problems for it, at least in the United States. Very controversial book, but he becomes well known. Now he's a writer. What's he going to write next? So meanwhile, he's exploring what's happening around him, automobiles, telephones, everything in Paris. And so he says, okay, so someone listening to this is having an experience. How could I paint the experience of the day? You know, you paint what's happening to people, or you sculpt it, or you make music out of it. So he said, okay, I can sit here and hear and listen to 10 languages in 10 seconds. I better put that on the page because that's what we experience. So he collages 10, well, it turns out to be 60 languages on each page. And so you don't read, the first thing is you don't read all the different little quotes, If you go up and down the dial, you're not going to remember everything you said. The content's kind of minimal. You just sort of look at the pattern of the experience. So he presents the pattern of what people were living in the early 20s, and what's that going to do to every previous institution? So you look at Finney's Wake as the book presenting a painting of new media. That's the beginning
that
point.
That makes sense, Bob.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's cool.
So he verbalizes, he paints the picture with the words.
Of an acoustic experience.
Of an acoustic experience.
And also it's got static. So on the first page, he has a 100-letter word. Except maybe Rabelais. Not many people put out a 100-lettered word. And that's the screech of the static while listening to the radio.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's very... So that's how you begin. Now, there's been many scholars who had no clue. That was McLuhan's understanding of what was going on, and he was unique. And a few other artists picked up on it. Many people thought that Ulysses, with its stream of consciousness, was mating book and movie. It was cinematic, the way he'd string out sentences without, or string out words and paragraphs without regular punctuation. That was pretty radical. That's in Ulysses. Mm. But that's what's happening when you're watching a movie. The images are just flowing in front of you. So,
yeah.
McLuhan liked to say that Finnegan's Wake, the next book, is mating book and radio. But as Joyce did this for 17 years, he had time to think about other media, television, what was coming. So he organized it into 10 thunders, 10 100-letter words, and the last word having one extra letter to make it 101. You put those 10 100s together, you get the Arabian Nights with 1,001 stories.
Mm.
So the endless media happening is a millions of stories. So Joyce is going to show the information overload that was coming. And
wow.
So he shows the history of technology. It took him many years to figure out these levels of making the book sort of not just a blatant collage. So there's a lot of order hidden underneath. And what else? So meanwhile, critics are just analyzing the words and trying to figure out a plot. They think it's a novel and they're trying to find a story. And that's a really frustrating enterprise. But they look up and find a lot of references to a lot of things because Joyce basically quoted the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica. That's where he got a lot of stuff. He would just cram content in. He's almost like a newspaper editor getting news stories and just dumping them on the page and then put it out and put more stories in the next day's paper. So he was miming radio and newspaper programmers, you know, makers. And so people would – so over the last, almost 100 years, people have annotated what the different lines mean, what the different – language and the words mean. So you can now go and get a book called Annotations of Finney's Wake, where every line and every section of the line, it gives you like two or three interpretations of what it could be, the top three interpretations. So you can look at it now and get all the particular content suggestions on each page, but also keep in mind the big picture that McLuhan laid. So you oscillate between the particular and the general.
Mm-hmm.
But are they close enough to Bob's interpretation?
The Ionic interpretation? Is that what you just said?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean,
if
you can get the annotate to your interpretation.
Yes. I see Ion is Finnegan's Wake in voice.
Yeah.
Finnegan's Wake predicts Ion. If you listen
That's
to enough of Ion, you
it.
Know that any kind of thing can be said and any language can be said and all the stuff that Ion does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you look at a scan through Finney's Wake and get familiar with it. You're actually looking at someone at Apple collating information on various face groups, people emailing and yelling at each other. There's a lot of yelling and screaming throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's like hyphen a line, next line, hyphen. So that thing that indicates conversation, there's all kinds of long stretches of crazy conversation going on and insulting and celebrating. That's what we now experience that in the chip body.
Yeah, Twitter wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, Twitter wars. So McLuhan, way back in the 50s, said that every technology possible is in Phineas Wake. So no one knew the Twitter war that was going to happen 50 years later, but it happened, and people have it as part of their experience. They can now look. I can say to a kid, and a 15-year-old, to get him interested in a book, this is a book that is showing you the cultural implications of Twitter wars.
Yeah.
And they'd be impressed. Oh, yeah, it is like Twitter, you know? Well, who was this guy? Yeah. When did he do this? 1920, 100 years ago? Holy shit, what is he, a genius or something? You know, the typical little man questions. What sign was he? How much money did he make?
What sign? He was a Gemini.
Yeah. So far it has predicted, and then now I say it predicted Ion, for fuck's sake. Now that's even more amazing.
Yeah.
And Ion does do email. He can Twitter with the best of them. And so when you look, there's all kinds of different levels of sophisticated or unsophisticated critics on Phineas Wake, but a lot notice that at a key point in the book, it's a machine you're talking. You're listening to a machine talking.
Mm.
You know, it's artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I think the thing that was quite fascinating watching Bill, Benny, and the thin thread or the thin line or whatever they were called was
thin
that
thread.
Graphical
thin
analysis.
Thread.
Thin thread. Mm. The thin thread was that graphical analysis where they were showing how they're collecting all of this data from these 2.5 billion cell phones or whatever it is. And there you can see the SMS going off along the line, and then you see the fax, and then an email, and that's just for one human being. So it was quite interesting, that point where you could actually see it graphically. I mean, you know, often you don't even think to yourself, well, I made a phone call and I sent an email. Somewhere there's this metadata that's being accumulated that's really pinpoints
showing
you
what you're
somewhere
including,
in,
what you're emitting.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
and that's the
old term for that is modeling. In systems development, that's what you do. You model out the objects, the locations, you know, every facet of the subject at hand, and you grab it, and that's how you build the computer or build those connections, those relationships, is what he talked about.
Well, Gene, I didn't know when I was a subject, so.
Yeah,
that's quite scary.
You're one of the 2.5 billion
that own a cell phone.
Yeah, that he was talking about. That was, when was that? That was how many years ago?
No, it was in the 90s. Because people got on, late 80s, early 90s, because people got on the internet in 93, 4, and 5. But they're on cell phones before that. So, late 80s, you could say.
Bob,
you say when the wall went down. The wall was a symbol of no privacy.
Yeah.
When the wall went down, there was no more privacy in the global theater, in the satellite environment.
It must have been cell phones and computers or something. It couldn't have been 2.5 billion cell phones in the early 90s. It was information sharing. I don't know.
Bob, do you see it all being switched off? On some level.
Well, that's what I am predicting. On May 5th, 2010, that's the die-off. When the EMP knocks out the global communications.
And so it'll knock out the satellites. That's where it starts. And then everything else
switches.
And
in effect,
off.
The fiber optics and all the other technology, and then people won't have their daily sustenance, and they'll die. And it'll be such a massive die-off that the Gulf won't be able to contain all the dead entities coming in there, and it will collapse and then spill back here. That was how Ion originally
was presented. Was that the representation of the blood flowing in Roxy's video? Would that be the...
No, the, when I talked about the blood flowing, that's in the Battle of Armageddon. Where
so there's
going to
be a
as
battle.
High as the horses.
Yes.
But the EMP, see, I think it's the May 5th session on Tailgate. It's very good. You listen to it. Well, in Tailgate, all of a sudden, Ion lays out this scenario. As a matter of fact, but, I think I have that as a separate item.
Which year, Bob? Which year?
2010. Let me just see if I've got... You got it. This is, if I look, I go back to the old howionic.com.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Have you found it, Bob?
Well, with my alternating web, it stops and starts. So I've got to figure out to do it. I'm trying Safari. It's not working. So now I got to go to Firefox and see if that'll work.
Oh, what a wonderful new internet service you have, Bob.
Right.
It's about to be obsolete, Gene, so he's not really too worried. I mean, he knows that that's not going to
be
around for long.
You must be transferring to the cloud real soon.
So I go to howionic.com and under addenda, it lists, I don't know, about 30 recordings. Emptying the Guff is the very first MP3. So you click on that, and that's 10 minutes long. So let's listen to this. You'll hear Allison's voice beginning. She goes, "Brian, Brian." She wants to say something to Brian or something. Okay, so Allison admits later that she was drunk and she was appalled at how she sounded. let's see. I got to make
Bob,
sure everything's
up. But
your
volume sounds a little not so good.
Well, it's we'll see. I have to organize things here. output, Soundflower, that. Let's see.
Your Skype setup.
Input, output, Skype, Soundflower, on, off.
Input, output.
Yeah.
Remember it, y'all. Skype, Soundflower, input, output, headphones. Four things.
Yeah. It's not going. I'm waiting for the making the button go, but let's see.
Well, your headphones, there was something about input, output, and make sure that your headphones, I think that's what creates
output,
the reverb.
Soundflower.
And then
that's
Skype.
Correct.
You got to do something with Skype.
Yeah, that's ready to go. So I can't even make the button go, so let's see. Go.
Yeah. Go. Go, Brian. Brian.
Okay, so it sounds like Ion saying Brian, but I think Al
sounds good
too. Oh, is that loud enough?
Yeah, it's perfect, Bob.
Okay, here we
go. Turn up the volume a little bit. It sounds like it's in your
I know,
like
I've got it maximum.
Your speaker or something.
Well, I noticed my headphones wouldn't work earlier. I think something's happened to my computer. Maybe the volume is weak.
What have you got your input and your output set to?
It's output and Soundflower, where it's supposed to be.
Okay, so Soundflower is selected.
Yep.
And what's your input?
Is there a volume on Skype? Input? What are you talking about?
Go ahead.
No, it goes. This is what we got right now. Here we go.
Okay.
I think I'll mute you because the noises, you want to hear this properly all 10 minutes. So let's make sure there's silence, which means I got to get this thing rehooked up. Is it going to work? Yes, it looks like it's going to work. Okay, I'll mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
Oh.
All participants are now muted. All participants are now unmuted.
This is like...
Okay. This was a big announcement that happened.
All participants are now muted.
Brian.
Yeah.
Brian.
Yeah.
No. Go, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. I appreciate that. Thanks. Go, Brian.
Yeah. You were talking about the guff, but the guff is emptying. When the veil comes down, when there is no veil, will the guff be empty?
No.
Okay. No. Now you are talking to us from the guff. When the veil comes down, what will be the interaction between...
Okay. Here's what I'll be. Okay. Do you know tides? Do you know how tides work?
Yeah.
No, Bob, we're talking to Brian. Brian, do you know how tides work?
Yeah, ocean tides, right?
Yeah, that's good. Okay.
You're pretty complicated. Yeah.
Go ahead, Aya.
There's a separation now, not with everyone, but with some human creators. There's this veil that separates you, the human creator, from you, the human creator, with power. Okay? So when the veil's thinning, you're finding a seepage. Your non-physical is becoming all, be all you can be. Well, that's all you can be. It's when you get this all hitting on every cylinder. Now, once that happens, once that occurs, some human creators are going to go into meltdown overload. And they'll start transitioning to a degree that you've never seen before on planet Earth. There won't be enough caskets to hold the bodies. There will be the mass exodus, bigger, way bigger than the Hebrews leaving Egypt. They will not choose to stay in physical because it'll overload their sensory perception that they can allow. But you're going to see more Haiti experiences where hundreds of thousands of human creators will start transitioning instantaneously. Large, vast numbers. Now, here's what that's going to do. In the party line of the flow of non-physical, you're going to have an influx to such a degree that the guff actually will become very, 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 very full, almost super full, a super concentration. And we're so glad you asked this question because this is the first time on planet Earth that it's ever been asked and answered. So kudos in your 14th hour, Bob, that you're going to get something new, fresh, 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 and new. The overflow, the overload that comes to the guff from this huge, vast dynamic. We're talking in the process of 500,000 to 1,000,000 or so, okay, in one lick. And can be much more than that. Just depends on the human creators who are participating at this degree and line up to be the fastest bat to their joy. So as we say 2, it could be 2 billion. But if we say 2 billion, it's 1 million and 1.5 billion, then we're less than because we missed it by 500,000.
You hey, guys, I'm back.
I know, we were talking.
Hey, guys, I'm back.
Okay?
Hey, guys, you're back.
Okay.
You guys are still going, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Let
Ian finish the statement, James. Just want to hear what Ian's saying.
Yep. Okay. So now, what happens is when that overflow or that tide rushes into the guff, okay, that overflow and that thinning of the veil will allow human creators full knowledge, instantaneous connection. And when that happens, that's when you'll start seeing heaven on earth as it is in heaven. And then at that point, there'll be no reason to transition to the gulf anymore. There'll be no reason to leave anything other than paradise, utopia, right here, right now. Then what happens is the procreation creation will be astonishing from all worlds at all levels. And the angels are going to be busy, 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 keeping everything lined up, because just life comes in, it's going to go out. And when it goes out this time, there'll be nothing to refill it, because those that will be in this new heightened sense of awareness and understanding their eternity and maintaining their power as a creator to create will have no reason to suicide out. There'll be no opt-out. It's like Obama's health care, health insurance. You get a penalty if you don't have insurance. Well, that's what'll happen when you start emptying the guff. There won't be a guff to go to, because you won't want to give up your physical power as a marvelous creator. Then the guff finally empties. And that's when you'll say, that's the day that time on earth shall be no more. Then you have utopia. Then you have paradise. Then you have heaven on earth as it is in heaven. Then the layers of heaven then get abridged, just like Finnegan's Wake tried to lay out. And then Dante's Inferno tried to scare the bejesus out of you, but it wasn't very effective, because that's where the... Before Dante, there was no hell, by the way, in case you were wondering. The good Christian that was bashed and not happy so writes the Inferno to give relevance and credence to the dogma of the moment. However, anyway, then you roll back into this place where once that veil is dissipated, the mercy seat is opened, the power that's in the mercy seat is absolutely laid out on humankind, human creators, all of them. And once that happens, then you really do only live in the now, Allison. There really is only now, because now your past, present, and future all become synced as one. It is the ultimate singularity. That singularity then allows inter-aspect, the superhighway between all worlds. So, Tina, you can visit your home if you want to and see what it's all like and what's going on. And then, Allison, you can travel to these other worlds and see what Tina's got going on, you alpha male, you marvelous creator. And you don't have to remember, because you know. If you remember it, you don't have to remember it, and it will flow freely and easily, perfectly to you. Nobody will be fighting over money anymore. Everything will be flowing freely and easily from a aspect of full source. There'll be no lack. There'll only be abundance. No contrast. And yet you'll still be able to create. It's the best of all realities, all rolled up into one middle kingdom aspiration of now. It's good. You won't need no police no more, because there won't be anything to police. You won't need any government anymore, because now the rule and reign of this consciousness of the Godhead is now resident on the throne, ruling and controlling itself. Your feelings become unhurtable. You become a masterful, marvelous creator. But you don't got to wait for all that. You got it right here, right now. If you got all the biscuits and gravy you can eat, so start sopping it up. Get you some sorghum and get you some butter and make you a bald-headed man and just eat yourself into an oblivious coma. It's all right with us. You can have paradise right here, right now. No lines, no waiting. But you're asking about a specific dynamic of an anomaly that will empty the guff, and what that looks like and what it will be like. It's never been described ever on the planet up until now. It's very wonderful, because it's what you now become a place of looking forward to. You see, your forwardness has nothing to do with your now, except it predicates your reality of your conscious, progressive thought, which is the essence of all creations. Now, once that happens, then the utopia comes into a new place and interactions between the other world, because now you have a superhighway better than an interstate system, can allow interaction back and forth, forth and back, back and forth, forth and back, to dynamic and delicious concept that you play with, it becomes instantaneously at your grasp and at your knowing. You human creators, you're so funny. You think you're the only one that is. Well, you are in your world. But to think that there's not dynamics and a larger creation process within you, you created this world. Who says you didn't create the other ones? Well, you did. And then inhabit them thereof. So this becomes the full